Hello and welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, we have been recording forever and now we are reaping the rewards because the World Cup podcasts are going out and amazingly, people seem to be quite enjoying them.
That's such a relief, isn't it? And actually, I'm really enjoying them because, as you say, we did them so long ago, lots of them. I mean, actually, it's ongoing. We've just finished one now before we're doing this episode. But lots of the ones that are going out at the moment, we recorded in late August, September, October. Yeah. So I can't actually, I've forgotten quite a lot of them.
Yeah, I had too.
And I've enjoyed listening back to them. And I've enjoyed the range, not just of subject matter, but of tone and style. Yeah. So the Germany one, I listened, and I'm not going to deny, Dominic, you brought a manly tear to my
That's
eye.
That's the effect I have on people.
I mean, I had no idea that you had it in you. But then Costa Rica,
yeah,
with the incredible evil of Dr. Valverde.
Yeah. We'll come back to him. We shall come to him later in this episode. But first, you've been unbelievably on your travels yet again.
I have. I've been to Romania.
What were you doing in Romania?
I got invited to give a talk on Dominion. Dominion's just come out by a lovely man called Matthai Blaj. I don't know if he's listening, but going to give him a shout out because he was absolutely the most wonderful of hosts. But when he invited me, I was kind of thinking, oh, I don't know, I'm so busy. Mm. But then he said, I will drive you to see the ancient Dacian capital of Sarmizegetusa, which is very high up in the mountains.
Yeah,
that's why it survived. So it's very inaccessible, very picturesque. Key to the story that I've been telling in Pax, the book that I may have mentioned I've been writing, because Trajan ends up storming it and the legions end up wiping it out. And everything that I've read about it, and I've read a lot, says basically you have to experience it properly to understand it. And so I thought of all the places that I've written about in Pax that I haven't actually been to, this is the one place that I really, really needed to go and see. And so I was thinking, how could I fit it in? How could I squeeze it in? And then Matthai wrote to me and invited me. So it was absolutely wonderful. So I said, yes. So yep. Sadie and I went, it was a flying visit. It involved a kind of rather brutal Wizz Air from Luton, which is a kind of nightmare.
I don't recommend.
The worst airport in Britain, which is saying something.
I don't think we get sponsorship from either Luton Airport or Wizz Air, are we, Tom? I've flown Wizz Air.
Wizz Air?
Skopje. From Luton.
Astonishing uniforms for their flight attendants. Very kind of vibrant pink.
So right.
Vibrant pink blouses and vibrant pink long coats, which I thought were rather stylish. So I prefer Wizz Air to the other ones.
What about the women?
Yeah. I don't think it's very progressive, Wizz Air. It doesn't have that vibe.
Yeah. Well, aren't they based in Hungary or something? I don't think that would be encouraged by the Orban regime.
Yeah, so there weren't many men in long pink coats, put it like that. So we flew to Cluj.
Oh, yeah.
Which has a museum of prehistory. We have an episode coming out on Serbia.
We do.
And the topic in Serbia is the question of whether Serbia and the Balkans more generally was the birthplace of writing, which may sound implausible to people who associate it with Sumeria or Egypt or whatever. But it is more than a possibility because there's a strange script, and we look at that in the episode that we've done on Serbia. And the key piece of evidence, perhaps, for it being writing are these mysterious tablets that were actually found not far from Cluj, and they're stored in Cluj.
Ooh.
And so I said to Matt, could we go and see them? And he rang up the museum and he said, I'm afraid that they're not on display. However, I have fixed for you to meet the curator who is going to get them out and you can inspect them yourself.
Oh,
so it was so exciting. So I went to the museum, met this wonderful woman who was is writing a paper on them. And she took them out and I could hold them and inspect them. And they were like little biscuits, the kind of biscuits that you dunk in tea. And the huge question is whether they are fakes or not. And she is engaging in research to try and test it.
And after you'd held them, did you get a sense of instinct?
Of whether they're real or not?
No, an instinct?
They felt a bit fakey to me, I'll be honest.
Really?
A bit fakey. My spidey sense.
Your spidey sense, yeah.
But I think the curator was giving nothing away. Was giving nothing away. And the reason that they're controversial is that they were found and they were baked. And so that means that they can't be carbon dated. Oh. So the creator is trying to think she's found a way to get over that problem and thereby to date them. So very exciting. So that was great. And so the next day, it was about a 3-hour drive to Samizdat-Getuza, high up in the beautiful mountains. It was fabulous, Dominic. It was one of the great, great archaeological sites that I've ever been to. It was spectacular. It was beautiful setting, kind of great trees, all the leaves turning orange. Very, very eerie. So there's a great citadel with walls, and then you go down this road, and the road has been preserved. It's kind of a paved road down to this very strange open space among the trees with a whole range of temples, which were wiped out by the Romans, but you can see the foundations, including this Stonehenge-esque kind of circle and a great altar with channels for the draining of blood. Mm. It was a very, very eerie place.
But Tom, is the stuff there to see, or are we literally talking about very low stones in a field?
Very low stones in a field, but spectacular and dramatic and atmospheric and eerie. And I think even you would be stirred by the trace elements of the Dacians.
There's a young member of my household who is desperate to go to Romania because he read Dracula over the summer, and he wants to go to Transylvania, and he wants to go to Brasov and Bran and all these places.
I think he'd enjoy Samizdat-Getuza, but I tell you what he would also enjoy is Hunyadi Castle, which is built by John Hunyadi, the great Hungarian defender of Christendom's southeastern flank against the Ottomans, and proto-user of tanks, like the Hussites. You know, they had wagons with guns pointing out, and he'd roll them down hills, and the Ottomans would run away. And he built this huge castle.
It looks like Hogwarts. It's identical to Hogwarts.
Well, basically, because it got rebuilt. Oh. So it's been rebuilt as a fantasy castle, essentially.
It looks amazing.
So that's one problem with it. The other problem with it is that Ceausescu built an enormous steelworks directly opposite it as a kind of V-signed flicked at history and feudalism. Right.
As Ceausescu's want, yeah. Ceausescu would be a great subject for the rest of his history.
But very spectacular. And quite a lot of, you know, the interiors are authentic. And reputedly, Dracula was actually in prison there, Vlad the Impaler.
Was he?
So Arthur might enjoy that.
He would. Well, Tom, you know how keen I am for us to do a pair. I'm going to say it right out. I'm going to say it in front of everybody. I think we should do a pair of episodes, one on the history of vampires.
Yeah.
In which you talk about vampires, and one on Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Or could we do Dracula more generally and include Vlad?
Well, I think you'd do Vlad. Would we do Vlad in episode one or episode two?
Maybe in episode two, because he's not a vampire. He's nothing to do with vampires.
Or is he? Well,
no, he's not.
Don't spoil the story. Anyway,
I think that would be great.
Why don't we do all that?
Yeah. But I highly, highly recommend Romania. I thought it was fantastic. It was beautiful. Loved it. So I had a fabulous time.
That's lovely. Now, the producers want me to ask you, have you watched the World Cup? Have you watched the opening match?
No, I haven't.
Well, it was terrible. I watched it.
And I tell you why. Go on. Tell me about it.
No, you tell me why. I want to know why you didn't watch it.
Well, because they scored, didn't they, in the first 2 minutes, and then it got cancelled on VAR.
That's right. Ecuador. Yeah. But they won anyway, 2-0. I mean, Qatar were abject. And I think the really interesting thing about this is following up what you said at the end of your Qatar podcast, which is the first one we did of our great marathon. You said, I can remember, you know, it's turned into such a poison chalice for Qatar. It'll be really interesting to see how it plays out, because they've done this partly out of sort of, it's an important way for them to say to the rest of the world, we are here and we are not, you know, going to be absorbed by Saudi Arabia or whatever.
It's like a cat spraying.
Yeah. And it's gone quite badly wrong, I would say, for them already, because they've just got this absolute torrent of negative publicity, haven't they?
But it depends who they're trying to impress, I suppose. I mean, I would imagine they're trying to impress their neighbours. Do they really care what liberals in Britain think?
Interesting question, isn't it?
I mean, they were never going to.
No.
And the what's his name? The president of
Infantino. What an absurd man he is. What an absolutely ridiculous man. He gave this. So for people who don't know, the Qatari World Cup, I was getting so much bad publicity that at the weekend, I think it was Saturday morning, Gianni Infantino, who's the Swiss, you know, Italian-speaking Swiss president of FIFA, delivered this extraordinary rant where, first of all, he said European nations should spend the next 3,000 years apologizing for what they did in the last 3,000 years, which is a lot of people
said. I felt he was letting the beaker people off. slightly lighter.
Yeah, also, what about the Persians? I mean, come on.
Well, and the Indo-Europeans generally behaving very badly.
He said that, but then he started this rant by saying, I am gay, I'm a migrant worker, I'm a Muslim, he sort of was laying claim. He was basically appropriating, the victimhood.
He was victim washing.
Yeah.
Well, he said he'd been a victim because he had freckles and people had laughed at him.
He had red hair at school and everyone had laughed at him, and that made him feel, he felt the pain of.
But it was a brilliant illustration of the way, if you can claim even a scintilla of victimhood, then it just wipes clean all your sins.
But it didn't though, did it? Because everyone laughed at him.
Yes. But that was his assumption.
Yeah.
But having said that, I mean, I think that there is an element of hypocrisy to the Western criticism of Qatar, say, for its attitudes on homosexuality. So, for instance, the England cricket team are going to Pakistan to play a 3-test series. Homosexuality is illegal in Pakistan. No one complains about that. And I think that the reason for that is because cricket has been much more integrated into the Muslim world for much longer.
It would seem absurd
Pakistan
not to
and Bangladesh.
Pakistan is one of the powers in cricket.
One of the great powers. And so it's been, it's never really been an issue. I mean, the thing is, Qatar is a Muslim state and it's governed by Sharia law.
Yeah.
And it's, same-sex relationships are illegal under that. And that's the way it is. And if you want to have a properly multicultural World Cup, you can't expect everyone to live by the standards of 21st century Western liberalism. I mean, homosexuality was illegal in 1966 when England hosted the World Cup.
Yeah.
So the pace of change has been very rapid. And it's, I think, a kind of expressive of a certain cultural chauvinism to expect every country to keep up with the rapid pace of what are very distinctively Western liberal opinions.
Such an interesting debating point. And you slightly raised this at the end of our podcast with Gary Lineker, where you said, if it is a World Cup, if it's a genuinely international tournament, and this would be Infantino's point, if it's a genuinely international football tournament, and of course we all know why it's in Qatar, because of money and gas and money. However, put that to one side, if it's an international footballing tournament, does it need to promote the very best of the Western liberal values that we hold dear, or does it need to reflect the value? I mean, so Peter Oborn wrote a column, I think it was for Middle East Eye, a website about Middle Eastern news from a very sort of pro-Middle Eastern perspective about Qatar. And he made exactly this point. He said, there are a lot of teams in the World Cup. In fact, the African teams, for example, where homosexuality is either very strictly stigmatized or is punishable by law. He also made the point that the COP, the climate business, had taken place in Egypt, and everybody had given Rishi Sunak, Britain's prime minister, a terrible time when he wasn't originally going to go. So he said, this is grotesque double standards. Egypt is arguably more oppressive than Qatar in some ways. Why is it you've got to go to the climate thing in Egypt, but you can't go to the World Cup in Qatar? I think there are a lot of issues to unpick here. So I watched the opening of the BBC program, where they spent half an hour, 40 minutes talking about the human rights issues in Qatar, about the Qatari government's position on homosexuality, for example, which all of us in kind of Western secular liberal countries find, incredibly off-putting, to say the least.
Probably wouldn't have done.
But might not have done, you're right.
In 1966.
Of course, wouldn't have done in 1966. But it was interesting that of all the pundits who were talking, they were saying how terrible it was, blah, 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 which all of us agree with. But nobody ever sort of questioned what they might have done 10 or 20 years ago, because it's interesting how much the cultural temperature has changed. Nobody ever sort of said, but it's not our place to lecture the Qataris.
Well, so I think there are two different things are being elided in this discussion in a way that is reflective of a certain degree of Western cultural complacency, I think. And they are things that are clearly wrong by the rubric of Islam. Mm-hmm. So the oppression, say, of migrant workers, Islam says that you should offer hospitality to foreign visitors, that the rich should care for the poor, and that they should give alms, and that the whole kind of institutionalized oppression of people is not something that Islam is at all approving of.
Yeah.
And Islam is also not in favor of corruption. It's not in favor of kind of people offering members of FIFA bungs and all that kind of stuff. So everyone can, I think, can accept that that is wrong. By the standards of Islam, as by the standards of Western liberal democracy, oppressing migrant laborers and corruption is wrong. Mm-hmm. However, by the standards of Islam, as traditionally and classically understood, same-sex relationships as prescribed, and this is a divine remit. If you're a Muslim, this is what you believe. And therefore, people from the West, assuming that Muslim countries should obviously subordinate themselves to the standards of the West, seems to me absolutely in a line reaching back to the Crusades. The assumption that the Crusaders had, that their understanding of, you know, that their Christianity was not just for the West, but for the entire world. It was mm-hmm. inherently universalist. That's what Catholic means, universal. Yeah. In that sense, liberalism is Catholic in its assumptions. It assumes that the whole world should accept what it thinks. Simultaneously, of course, liberalism is in favor of multiculturalism. It's in favor of diversity. It's in favor of diversity as our strength.
Yeah.
But I think the Qatar World Cup pinpoints in a way that most people in the West don't see, liberal commentators don't seem to have picked up on, that there is an inherent tension there.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't celebrate diversity while simultaneously saying everyone should accept our understanding of gay rights. You've got to say, is the Western understanding of gay rights so true that everyone in the world should accept it, and it doesn't matter what Muslims think?
Which probably a lot of our listeners would say, yes, it is so true. Because I'm just thinking about our listeners, generally, you know, tolerant, liberal-minded people.
Do they also then think that other cultures should subordinate their traditions?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
to
the
reflect
issue, isn't
that.
It?
Which is absolutely expressive of the kind of Victorian liberal imperialism mm-hmm. that now we're all condemning. I mean, you can't have both.
I agree with you, Tom. I think it's a fascinating tension. I don't think it can be resolved. I think FIFA, you know, to let there be no doubt, the fact that the World Cup is happening in Qatar at all is gross corruption and sort of money grabbing by FIFA. But the one of the sort of pleasures of this, in a way, is that Infantino and FIFA are trying to ride both horses.
Of course they are.
And it's all going horribly wrong for them, because they promote
some people.
They endlessly promote all the sort of rainbow stuff, diversity, blah, 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 blah. You know, they sort of, I don't know, there must be some sort of washing word for
it. The hypocrisy is so glaring.
But now, in this case, they don't want it to be, you know, so there's a big controversy while we are talking about whether the England captain in today's match will be allowed to wear his One Love armband, which captains of some of the European nations have agreed to wear, which is kind of, I think it's got rainbow colours on, and it's sort of all about diversity and inclusiveness and all this kind of thing. And FIFA have threatened that captains who wear these armbands will be booked and possibly suspended for games if they wear this unsanctioned armband, because they want them to wear their own armbands, which have much more anodyne, let's all be kind kind of messages.
But the footballers, I don't think, get off this scot-free. Because it's not as though, you know, top flight football is full of gay players, is it? I mean, it probably is, but they're not out.
No, I'm not going to beat up on the footballers. I mean, a footballer's a short career. There are not many World Cups.
Yeah, but I think that if you are in a working environment mm-hmm. where evidently gay players are not coming out, they're afraid to come out, they're nervous of it. They're nervous, I guess, of maybe how their colleagues will, their fellow players will react, and maybe mm-hmm. nervous of how sponsors, I don't know what the reason would be.
Are they nervous? I don't think they are nervous of their fellow players. I think they're nervous of fans.
Right.
And
okay.
of the wider, the media. And I would suspect that there are players in the Premier League, let's say, or in other leagues, who it is known, you know, don't have a girlfriend, maybe have a, you know, whatever. And their teammates probably know about it, don't mind, because their teammates are products of our 21st century world, Tom. I mean, they're not, you know, they're not sort of Neanderthals. Their teammates are probably completely fine with it, but they just don't talk about it because they, again, the media, and they don't want the other fans taunting them.
Okay, but I still think that it is evident that it's not a gay-friendly environment.
Yeah.
Professional football.
Okay, listen, Tom, do you know what's happening? We've been talking about this so long. We got bogged down in restless politics style.
But just
empty blather.
No, I know.
And our just one other thing is sending us reprimanding
us. But just one other thing. We talked about this in relation to 1978 Argentina World Cup, that basically only one player decided not to go because he was morally offended by it. I mean, it's absolutely up to football players if they disapprove of going to Qatar not to go. And obviously they've all gone.
I think that's putting an onus.
Well, fine.
On very young men, Tom. 2021? I mean, come on. It's very young men who or indeed older men. I mean, Lionel Messi, let's say, probably or Ronaldo, the world's most famous players, they carry the weight of hundreds of millions of people cheering them on. To not go is a tough decision for somebody. It's not just about the money, because they have enough money. It's about
the glory.
The glory, writing a last chapter in their story,
course,
and knowing
I
they will disappoint
that.
So many people.
Yeah,
they
course.
Will disappoint far more
that.
People than they'd please.
I understand that, but I think that kind of, you know, wearing armbands isn't really making a statement in the way that not going would make a statement.
To go back to a tiny bit of sporting history, in 1980, Mrs. Thatcher wanted Britain to boycott the Moscow Olympics, as Jimmy Carter had got the Americans to do because of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And they were asking loads of athletes what they thought. And of course, the athletes were put under tremendous pressure. They didn't boycott the Olympics in the end. But Daley Thompson, the great British decathlete, probably the greatest all-round athlete of the 1980s anywhere in the world, was asked about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. He said, "I don't give a damn about it. I just want to go and win gold." And he did. Now, maybe you're saying you'd respect the players.
That is a more honest perspective. I think that, you know, that wearing an armband while going and making all the money and getting all the glory is trying to have it both ways.
You would never do that, Tom, yourself, right?
No, of course not. Of course not. But it's moral cakeism.
Okay, cakeism. Right, the producers are outraged by that. We've spent 20 minutes talking about this. And so, you know, if you're outraged too, you're not alone.
Okay.
Qatar. We've done four episodes already, or four that have gone out. Qatar was the first one that was it was a survey of the whole country's history, which you did brilliantly, Tom. And we've got a question from Xander Fearon, and he says, why wasn't Qatar gobbled up by Saudi Arabia?
Because it had the British and the Ottomans, and it was playing multiple geopolitical powers. Mm-hmm. So it was relying on basically imperial outsiders, i.e. the Ottomans and Britain, to keep the Wahhabis at bay.
That's right. But also, isn't it not also the case that there was no Saudi? I mean, there's no Saudi Arabia to gobble it up to some extent.
Yeah.
So it's, there's a lot of internal tensions in Arabia anyway, rivalries between clans and things. So it's not like they're in a position to be able to gobble anybody else, because they don't gobble up Bahrain or the other so-called crucial states. Or
It's a British colony until, 71?
Yeah.
And then it is subordinate to Saudi Arabia. I mean, its foreign policy is determined by Saudi Arabia. And everything that, you know, Al Jazeera, the World Cup, all that kind of stuff is basically an attempt to ensure that it won't be gobbled up by Saudi Arabia.
Well, it has worked to some extent because the Saudis have gone to Qatar, Saudi princes or whatever. Yeah.
That boycott has ended.
Yes.
Right, Dominic. Germany, which I thought was fabulous. I couldn't believe how the impact of that. I thought it was incredibly powerful, which I didn't feel at all when we were doing it.
That's when you're looking at me, Tom. I just put you off.
That must have been it. So Jan M, I listened to this episode while on the train, had to do my very best not to cry. Amazing bravery and inspiring story and very well told. CJM, brilliant episode, had a few tears at the end. Stephen Clark, Sophie and Hansel are perhaps the most impressive and humbling individuals from the whole history of the 20th century. That's high praise.
That's
long live freedom.
It is a wonderful, it's nothing to do with the story. The podcast is just, it's an extraordinary story. The interesting thing is, obviously, in their own lifetimes, to an extent, they didn't achieve anything. I mean, that sounds like a terrible thing to say, and it completely undercuts what I said in the episode. But in sort of short term, you know, there was no mass uprising against Hitler. Life went on. But they matter enormously, don't they? For modern Germany's sense of itself. But also for our sense of humanity and the 20th century, because otherwise, I often think this, reading sort of Steven Pinkerish narratives about human progress, the 20th experience of the 20th century casts such a shadow over the current moment, the Holocaust, the horrendous death toll in so many wars, the cruelty and so on. And so stories like The White Rose are so important to give us a sense of a modicum of faith in human nature.
Well, you say faith. I mean, they were They were inspired by the Christian model of martyrdom.
Very self-consciously.
And perhaps that's what led them to, in a way, court the fate that they had.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? When they're captured. Yeah. Are they, why don't they make more of an effort? But actually, you know what, we could maybe that's to descend too deeply into kind of murky waters, because the sense of panic that you might have, you know, they're quite young, you know, who knows why they suddenly froze. It might not just be because they wanted to be martyrs. It might be because they were in a state of shock. They didn't know what to do. Why they threw the leaflets around so recklessly, I suppose that is the...
And especially when they'd spent so long, you know, going to different towns and posting them and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Then maybe it was it high-spiritedness? Was it, you know, I mean, who knows? Yeah,
Who knows? Anyway, so that was very moving. And then we had a completely different kind of episode, The Somerton Man. So that was Australia's contribution.
I have to say, I loved that episode. It's one of the strange things about this series is that we do what we sometimes do a bit in the podcast, which is sort of one of us tells the story and the other is basically yes, no, hello, goodbye. and you told the Somerton Man story. I had deliberately not read up on it. I think partly
because I didn't know about it at all.
No, I'd never heard of it. I probably would have read something, but to be honest, I was so busy preparing World Cup episodes that I just thought, sod it, I'll let Tom tell that story. And actually, sometimes it's nice to do that, to approach it from the perspective of a listener who doesn't really know anything about it. I think that is one of my favorite ever Rest Is History episodes, just because, well, it's such a brilliant story. And a lot of people, somebody said, this is what we, you know, this is what the world needs, another true crime podcast. But
it's our first one.
Yeah. And I think a mystery is a great, is an inherently wonderful narrative style.
And the thing is that it may actually not be a crime, because it seems probable that it was actually suicide.
Yeah.
Maybe. So this went out on Saturday.
Who knows?
Saturday. On Sunday, the ABC in Australia put out a documentary about it.
Yeah.
And they found more photographs of this guy, Carl Webb, who almost certainly was the Somerton Man. And his backstory is pretty grim. I mean, he seems to have behaved very badly to his wife. I think the likeliest explanation seems that he went there and he committed suicide. Although obviously there are still all kinds of mysteries. You know, what was his relationship to Jessica Thompson? Why was he there?
Anthony Sanders says maybe he had visited or called Jessica Thompson. She was a nurse to get the drugs to kill himself with.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Maybe he stole his brother-in-law's clothes to hide his tracks. I mean, that was a weird thing. T. Keen, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, T. Keen tweeted, I don't know if you saw this, and said, I found this very weird listening to this. My name is Thomas Keen.
Well, I mean, there are still lots of mysteries there.
So a couple of people, MB1872 and Stephen Clark, were discussing the cigarettes. Why was he putting expensive cigarettes in a cheap box? A suggestion is that he might have been a gambler who was pretending to be poorer than he was. I mean,
or he might have catched some cigarettes off somebody and had.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? I don't know.
Absolutely fascinating. So this is the recent development is the discovery of photos of him and more information.
Which he looks very handsome.
Right.
Very handsome looking man.
But strange ears, isn't that right, Tom?
His ears don't leap out at you when you see him.
Okay.
Kind of in a row with other people. And then Costa Rica.
Right. Well, so I was worried we'd oversold Costa Rica because I remember us laughing a lot at in the middle of the podcast. And then I listened to about the first 20 minutes or so and I thought, are we massively oversold this? It's very dry. It's all about Costa Rican coffee.
No, it was interesting.
And then the narrative really gets going. I think what makes it so funny is that you have no idea who's on which side, who anybody is, and who you're meant to sympathise with.
Who I'm supposed to be rooting for.
Yeah, who you're rooting for. So when Dr. Valverde appears, shortly to be shot dead, and you describe him as the embodiment of evil. I mean, they have a statue of him. Somebody put up a picture of him. There's a statue of him in a hospital. And it says, like, great lover of his country.
Love, cares for sick people.
Exactly.
Kind to orphans.
Exactly. I mean, that was very, very funny. And Simon Girdleston one might, if one was being critical, one might say he did more digging on Dr. Valverde than I did on the entirety of Costa Rican history.
I mean, in my defense,
yeah.
I was hearing it for the first time as you were hearing the Somerton Man. Yeah, I knew nothing about Costa Rica.
Yeah, no.
So I didn't have time to go and dig up this.
But Simon Girdleston has dug up a lot of stuff, which he translates, or I think Mr. Google translated from Spanish. There's some very amusing translations on the Discord. A citizen of honor, a distinguished patriot. He traveled to Europe and became a doctor in Paris, all this kind of stuff. A very impressive man, Dr. Valverde. Not a frog torturer.
Another aspect of his remarkable personality was his devotion to the homeland and his example as a citizen of honor and distinguished patriot. That sounds very Google Translate.
It is very Google Translate.
But Simon Girdleston, imagine damning a heroic doctor as an evil frog murderer. I think the authors should play a benefit match in his honor. I think Simon may have a point
but
there.
But a terrible thing happened, didn't it, late yesterday, when somebody sent us a message to say the president of the Christian Democratic Party of Costa Rica is now listening.
Going to listen.
Has read your tweets and is now listening to this episode. And I've been looking at his account every now and again with kind of bated breath.
Terror.
Yeah, to see.
I hope he's not from the same party as Dr. Valverde.
No, I mean, you don't know, do you? Costa Rican politics, I mean, it's febrile.
Who knows?
Yeah, that was fun, though. I enjoyed the Costa Rican story. I think the thing was, we'd done the White Rose and then we'd done Somerton Man and it was time for a bit of comedy.
Lake, Tom's complete innocence in this topic was a joy to listen to, and I think a reflection on how we all perceive Central American countries. I constantly expecting there to be an evil character appearing from nowhere and causing ruin. I think that is it. I think it was my sense, again, you accuse me of never reading novels. I think it's my sense of magical realist story set in South American countries where there would be doctors who torture frogs and things.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
just the kind of thing that would happen. But there was somebody, and I can't remember if it was on the Discord or Twitter, said that it might be fun for us to do episodes on areas of history that we know nothing about and just make stuff up completely about the characters we're talking about.
Magical realist episodes of the rest of history. Yeah. Tom, I know you have read novels because you did an English degree, but I think your novel reading now, what percentage of your total reading would novels?
Well, I'm a man who over the age of 40, and men over the age of 40 apparently
don't read
their consumption of novels starts to decline.
And has it?
But Dominic, I haven't got time to read novels.
Tom, here's the difference.
I'm endlessly having to read books about
you've always read a lot of nonfiction for pleasure. And about 5 or 6 years ago, I pretty much stopped reading nonfiction for pleasure just because I was doing so many reviews. And I just thought, I felt awful because I felt a lot of it was just so wasted because 2 years later, I'd forgotten what was in the book. You know, I might read a book about the Templars, I don't know, War of the Spanish Succession, President Andrew Jackson, whatever. And then 2 years later, it was as though
I hadn't read
it. It's all gone, not retained in any way.
Isn't that the fun of the podcast? Suddenly, there's a purpose to all this stuff you're reading.
Well, that's true, but sometimes I look at early episodes of the podcast and I think, I remember nothing of that at all. You know, if you gave me a quiz now, Tom, about Babylon, I would perform atrociously.
But you remember the Statue of Marduk.
I remember the Statue of Marduk. That's only because we've mentioned it again and again. But it's all in one ear and out the other. It's very depressing. Yeah. Anyway, this is my reason for reading novels.
So I was planning to read lots of novels over my holiday in Greece.
And
I took loads of novels.
You read about Trafalgar.
I just read about Trafalgar.
Yeah.
And I felt guilty about it. But then I thought, I'm on holiday, I can read what I like.
Yeah, you can. Oh, yeah.
And to be honest, so I did read a few novels, and I quite enjoyed them. But I didn't enjoy them as much as reading about the Battle of Trafalgar.
Oh, that's a tribute to...
I think that reflects very well on me and my zeal for king and country.
Reflects well on Nelson, I think, Tom. So just to, before we do the last thing, which is about popes, just to give you a sense of what's coming up. By the time this goes out, you probably will have listened to our episode about Croatia, which is about the Emperor Diocletian, isn't it, Tom?
It is. And maybe Uruguay, which is...
The Tupamaros, with a bit of music.
I think on the same day as this, yes. Yes. And not the only bit of music that we're going to have in this series, I hasten to add.
So further ahead, we have the Ashanti Wars, the special relationship with the United States, but done from some very oblique angles. We're thinking about doing the Day of the Dead in Mexico, about the island of Gorée in Senegal. Any others that you're particularly looking forward to, Tom?
Yes. We've got the Kaaba in Saudi Arabia. We've got courtesans in Korea. Yeah, lots of stuff.
The Caliphate of Cordoba. That was a good one.
Got that. Yeah,
very good. So somehow, to my horror, a conversation on the Discord has degenerated into talk of popes, a World Cup of
bishops of Rome. I missed this. This must have been when I was in Romania and I couldn't get the Discord.
Yeah. So this is very much up your street, Tom. People want a World Cup of popes. Nano says, would it be an easy win for Gregory VII? Bistu Verrucht says Alexander VI. Warrior says Pope Urban II. And Abigail Muncy, quite rightly, says she is Catholic and she would love a Pope episode. The wackier and more controversial, the better. Honestly, Stanley Baldwin, that is me, can be as rude as he wants as far as I'm concerned. In fact, I demand it.
So, would Tom, you be rude about the Pope?
Yeah, I probably would. Just kind of living up to the...
Your Protestant love of beef.
Yeah.
Would demand it.
We've got an episode coming up on beef. On beef and liberty. Just to play up to the sort of ludicrous stereotype, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
But that aside...
Well, you know I love popes.
Of course you do. Alexander Pope.
Yeah. Ollie Pope, the England batsman.
Yeah, there's a Nick Pope in the England squad. Listen, who would you be backing in a Pope's World Cup?
Gregory the Great, of course, because he's great. There's a clue in the name.
Thanks for that, Tom. What about, I don't know, Boniface the 12th or something? St. Peter. Who would you really be backing? St. Peter?
He's the rock.
What about more modern?
Jesus rates him.
Pius the 12th or something? I don't know.
I mean, we know for a fact, yeah. A literal fact, mm-hmm. that Jesus rated Peter.
Okay.
It's in the Gospels. It's gospel.
How do you think John Paul II would do? I think he'd do very well.
I think he'd do well. But I think Gregory the Great, for all kinds of reasons.
Where would you put Benedict?
The recent one.
Yeah, whatever number he was.
Yeah, was he 16th? Can't remember.
I'm not really a favourite popes, Tom, if I'm completely honest.
I want to do popes. I want to do Gregory the VII. You know this.
Which one's Gregory the VII?
What?
Which one is he? Is he Gregory the Great?
No, Gregory the VII is Canossa. He's the one who makes the emperor kneel in the snow.
Oh, God almighty, yeah. Every time you mention that, the producers absolutely, their faces drop and they just say, how would we sell this to... Julia Gillard, and that man from Costa Rica.
We sell it by saying the most important event in European history.
You'd have to work hard. You'd have to work very, very hard to justify that, Tom.
I wouldn't. It's easy. No, it's an easy, easy victory. And so I think we should do that, and I think we should do that in the new year.
Okay, well.
Laying on the record.
Are you going to do the Crusades? Well, that's your kickoff for the Crusades, isn't it?
I think we should do the first millennium, which is a great topic. We should do Canossa.
Yeah.
And then we do the Crusades. Because we can't really understand the Crusades without Gregory the VII.
Without a couple of episodes promoting your book first. Is that what you're basically saying?
No, I wrote that book because I wanted to know why the Crusades happened.
Okay, fine. Good answer. Right, we should wrap up. Before we wrap up, now the listeners will be listening to this, Tom, after this has happened. So they will be able to judge us. Let's make our predictions for two of today's World Cup matches. So first of all, I need a score from you for Iran versus England.
2-0 to England.
Okay, I'm going to say 1-1. And then the USA versus Wales.
1-0 to America.
I'm going to say 0-0. I'm going for a very drab opening to the tournament. Yeah, you can tell. Such is my personality. Right. We will be doing podcasts every day, and then we'll be back with a bonus episode, I imagine, next week. So you'll be sick of us by then.
Could I just say one last thing?
Come on,
which is
Columbo.
No, my brother and I are doing an event in aid of Alzheimer's support in Salisbury on the 9th of December. And this will be going to be recorded. It will go out both on the Rest is History feed and We Have Ways feed. And it's in... excellent cause, 9th of December in Salisbury. And if you Google our names, the title of the talk is Brothers in Arms. You should be able to find it. So if you can come to that, it would be hugely appreciated. Very, very good cause. Many, many thanks.
What an unbelievable treat. And what kindness, trademark kindness from Tom Holland.
I don't like to boast about my charity work, Dominic.
No,
you know
of course you don't. Of course you don't. The maybe your trust peerage has gone. But who knows? The Sunak period cannot be many months away. So go to Tom's thing. If you don't go to it, listen to it and give him your money. And on that note, goodbye.
Bye-bye.